Hello, and welcome to Broad Appeal, the podcast that looks back at female-driven films from the not-so-distant past. I'm Brian.
I'm Sean.
Sean, darling, get your fingers out of that tera masalata.
I'm sorry, Brian, I just love the taste of whipped fish.
Why is it that we're indulging in Greek delicacies?
One, because I'm super as always, and two, we're in Greece!
That's right, ladies and gentlemen, we are not actually recording this podcast from Greece, but through the brilliance of the World Wide Web, it is arriving to your earbuds while we are baking on the sun in the island of Corfu for a week. A well-deserved break, wouldn't you say?
I'm having a great time.
I think of us kind of like those two women from Mamma Mia who are not Meryl Streep. Do you want to guess who's Christine Baranski and who's Julie Walters?
Well, I don't know. It could be either one of us at certain points in the day.
Yeah, but you started having that frenetic dance with lots of locals on a beach. You know,
has this actually happened?
Well, I'm just predicting that you're going to start walking around with some local Greek youngsters saying, "Does your mama know that you're out?" Meanwhile, I'll just be alone by myself, mopily singing
Chiquitita.
Anyway, the taverna looks wonderful.
It does.
Ladies and gentlemen, before we embark on our holiday, we have to record an episode. We've read a book. That book has been made into a movie, which we're about to watch. And it features an actress that we've never covered. So there's lots of excitement about this.
The book is Looking for Mr. Goodbar, written by Judith Rosner, published 1975, and was made into a 1977 motion picture, directed by
Richard Brooks.
Thank you. And starring Diane Keaton, who we adore.
God, I can't believe we've never done Diane Keaton.
Oh, jeez. Can't believe we've never done her.
La-di-da, la-di-da.
And Tuesday Weld, who I know nothing about except that her first name is the day of a week.
That's right. And Richard Gere. But we'll get to the film in a minute. Now, what did you know, or how did you know, about the book Looking for Mr. Goodbar?
Okay, to be honest with you, I haven't told you this. You know I have an encyclopedic knowledge of The Simpsons from 1990 to about 2001-2002. And in one episode of The Simpsons, which I described to you the other day, in which Homer is accused of sexual harassment. But in this episode, him and Marge go to a big candy convention, and there's an announcement over the tannoy that they are looking for Mr. Goodbar. Repeat, we are looking for Mr. Goodbar.
And did you understand this was a joke?
Well, I knew it was a joke, I just knew I wasn't getting it. But then, about a year later, I realized there was a book on my mother's shelf called Looking for Mr. Goodbar. And then when I got the Simpsons anthology, it said it was a joke that was referencing the film of the same name. So I knew that there was a book and a film called Looking for Mr. Goodbar, aged about 12. I knew
That's
this.
Interesting. So did you ever ask your mother what Looking for Mr. Goodbar was about?
No, I read the back of the book.
I'm surprised. So you read the back of the book and then thought...
It was on a really low shelf, on a bookcase at the top of the stairs. So as I was going up the stairs, there was two things that I always noticed. Looking for Mr. Goodbar, The Naked and the Dead, and a biography of Elizabeth Taylor by Kitty Kelly.
And we wonder why you turned out the way that you did. Now, what's fascinating, this is amazing, we've actually never talked about this before. My family had a similar bookshelf. There was one section of the bookshelf which was lots of trade paperbacks that were from around the kind of mid to late 70s. And I can only assume they were from the times when my father and mother were kind of a young married couple, or maybe even they were from when my mother, before she married my dad, kind of quite worn paperbacks. And one of them that I can vividly remember seeing is Looking for Mr. Goodbar. And in my memory, it was next to a similarly slightly sexy, risque, but more comic novel, Coffee, Tea, or Me.
I've heard of that line.
It's a raucous sex farce about stewardesses. Either my father or my mother was into like slightly salacious trade paperbacks from the mid to late 70s. Did you start reading the book?
No. I mean, adult books were still
verboten.
I just didn't get them.
Later read Peyton Place?
No, I watched Peyton Place. I read Valley of the Dolls.
Okay, well,
I read Valley of the Dolls when I had appendicitis.
Sometimes camp is the best medicine. But anyway, so obviously we've now read quite a few books. We're nearing the end of our list. But when all these books arrived from Amazon's used book marketplace, most of them, you got really excited about Looking for Mr. Goodbar, and you pulled it open. I think it was around Christmas time and started reading the start of it.
Well, I felt very excited because this had been something that I literally had seen on the top of the stairs for years.
I had to actually stop you from reading this book because I was like, Sean, we're not doing this until like the 8th or 10th book in the series. You've got to read the other ones first.
Well, it began quite explosively.
Yeah. Do you want to give our listeners a flavor of that?
Absolutely. It begins with a testimony, and this is not a spoiler, of the man who kills the main character, Teresa Dunn, who in the film is played by Diane Keaton. And this gives you a flavor of what exactly we're talking about. This is the murderer. Then she says to me, "You queer like your friend?" "No, cunt," I say. "I'm not queer like my friend. God is my witness. I never talked that way to a woman in my life." She just... Anyhow, she sort of yawns, stretches out, and she says, "I think you are. I think maybe if I feel like getting laid tonight, I ought to go back downstairs and find someone straight." Naturally, that pisses me off. All I need is for this miserable cunt to go back down and tell everyone I'm a queer. As soon as I get pissed off, I get a little turned on, right? So I say to her, "You're not going anywhere." She says, "Maybe you're right." She starts to get undressed. "Maybe you're right. I'm tired. I'm going to sleep." Getting undressed like I wasn't there. Then she says to me, "I should slam the door on my way out." So naturally, the next thing you know, I'm bawling her, right? We went a good long time. I don't know. Or fuck, what's the... Yeah, so we're finished and I'm feeling okay. You know, relax. The only thing in my head now is maybe I get some sleep. Now I don't have to hear any more of that queer shit, and I close my eyes. And his voice trembles and he has difficulty continuing. With great effort, he forces himself to start talking again. And then, I'm half asleep and this voice says, "You can go now." "Why?" I ask. "Because I don't want you to sleep here. Why don't you want me to? I'm stalling. I mean, I can't do it. I don't give a fuck. My head is... The blood's pounding in my head." "Because I hardly know you," she says. "I just fucked you pretty good, didn't I?" "Okay," she says. "Just okay."
I can understand why you wanted to carry on reading it, and I had to restrain you.
Yeah.
Now, it may be obvious, but there are just, like, glaring, dated ideas and nomenclature that are, like, kind of raising lots of red flags for me. This book is about a young, sexually liberated, quote-unquote, woman in the singles bar scene. There's this kind of danger and possible rape and violence that's going on. And we learn right from the beginning that she's killed. So what is it making you think as a reader before you start reading the book?
So I give them the benefit of the doubt. I kind of enjoy reading this kind of reprehensible dialogue sometimes because it makes me think about the society we're in now and the society we're in then and how things have changed. It's pulpy and it's salacious and it's dirty and it's sexy and there's death and violence, and I want to read that.
Apparently it was based on a real-life murder case that Judith Rossner researched and was going to write about for Esquire, but there was some legal issue, and so she then sort of transposed all the research she'd done into this novelistic account.
They wouldn't publish her article, would
yeah.
they?
Yeah. Actually, Nora Ephron was her editor.
What?
For Esquire, yeah. Yeah, but so in some of the particulars, the book follows the real-life murder case that the young woman who was murdered was an Irish-American girl grown up in the Bronx in a strict Catholic family. She had kind of moved to Manhattan, apparently was known around the kind of bar scene for kind of coming in and reading and meeting lots of people, allegedly also taking home lots of men to have sex with on one-night stands, and one of these encounters near New Year's Eve followed some of the outlines of what happened here. As we started reading this book, it's not just like a true crime story about this murder, right? It becomes, I don't know, and these is where all my red flags were flying like a fucking matador in the corridas in Madrid. It just seems like she wants to turn this story of this one woman's bad sexual encounter resulting in murder into like a diagnosis of the entire sexual revolution, the entire position of women's sexuality in the transition from the 60s to the 70s. Am I reaching for the stars here, or is this... what you interpreted as well.
Yeah, of course, but also that you can't have anything. You can't be sexually voracious and liberated, and you can't get married either. Both of them are bad options.
So who is Teresa Dunn?
Well, she's this mousy girl who, we're told, spent a year in hospital as a child because of polio, and it's caused her to be very insular about how she interacts with people and kind of very suspicious of her own body and her own sexuality.
She has like a scar on her back because the polio has resulted in some kind of scoliosis or issue with her spine, right? She has some trouble walking, a slight limp. Something to do with the polio also has to do with her brother having died as a boy, and then her parents were so grief-stricken that they didn't pay attention to her polio. I don't know. I have to say, I was just getting like the Freud alarm, like going off. It's like, oh, young girl, sexually repressed, confused about her body, her older sister is pretty, or her other sister is, like, getting married, her older sister has an abortion, you know, Catholic guilt is, like, filtering down, all sort of over-determining the kind of psychological fucked-upness of this one girl, Teresa.
I completely agree. Also, there's so goddamn much of it. We are going to go through all these things that happen that justify every action she takes as an adult.
And then she goes off to City College. She's a goody-two-shoes Catholic schoolgirl, but she is exposed to the influence of a man. Who is this man?
He's her English professor, isn't he?
And he deflowers her.
Can I also say, they obviously didn't have any foreplay in the 70s. It's all just penetration. It is.
We'll get to that. So she's deflowered by the teacher. She kind of connects with him. Of course, he breaks her heart and doesn't want to stay with her.
Because he's got kids and is married.
Yeah, and he seems to do this to one, you know, nubile co-ed every academic season. And she's just the latest one. And then this kind of sets her off on this series of sexual adventures where she increasingly leaves behind the strictures of Catholicism and the sense of propriety. And of course, the 60s are moving forward as well. So even though the book was written in 75, the action is kind of taking place from the early to the late 60s.
That is so specific.
They're discovering pot and they're going out to Fire Island. And
the sexual revolution in general is happening around them.
Her sister and brother-in-law, they like doing kind of wife swapping couple things with other people. And she's kind of in the midst of it all. And she's a young girl living in the village. Right, so you get all this sense that she's like an Alice falling through this kind of wonderland world. And she eventually becomes quite comfortable, I guess, with the idea that when she's horny and when she wants to, she can just go by herself, unaccompanied, late at night to like the local bar, expect men to buy her drinks. She doesn't even bring money with her, right? Because she doesn't want to buy her own drinks. So she expects men to buy her drinks and like regularly just takes them home and has sex with them. Sometimes really great sex, other times less than appealing. And she kind of disassociates this aspect of her life from the other aspect of her life, which is what? She's like a primary school teacher.
She's a good one, it seems.
Yeah, and she's really into it. But she's also constantly fixated on her body and her self-esteem and also, like, not wanting to get married, not wanting to have kids, not wanting to be square and domestic, yeah? And this is where I think the book, for me, just gets into a woman from 1975 looking back at everything that has led to, like, the sexual revolution and the women's movement with this very critical eye to me.
Well, this is the thing. It's like, I still don't know, having read this. Well, I think I do a little bit, but I don't know where Judith Rossner was coming from.
I feel like Judith Rossner, to me, was coming from having read this horrific story about a very unlucky young woman who got murdered and then has just turned it into a cautionary tale that all women are lied to by the idea that they can both have sexual pleasure with multiple anonymous partners and survive. Like, they either are gonna be totally emotionally fucked up, or they're gonna die, or both. Teresa's sister, Catherine, has how many abortions?
A few.
And three marriages. Yeah. And she, although she doesn't get brutally murdered, she also seems to be very unhappy. And they have this weird sisterly relationship where they're both kind of like competitive with each other, but hiding secrets from each other and kind of vindictive. Increasingly, as the book goes on, I mean, it's very readable and it's very pulpy and enjoyable. The content just increasingly made me want to retch. This is a woman writing about another woman. This would make so many people who might have had sexual experiences of this type, you know, hot, fun, horny experiences with strangers or people they didn't know that well, and think, Jeez.
I'm going to die next time.
I'm going to die. I'm not sure there's much more to this book other than scare tactics.
Yeah, but also the idea that, you know, there's a lovely guy out there who's going to take care of you and be nice to you is presented as just as unappealing in some ways.
In the middle section, she kind of begins to have two simultaneous relationships with a good boy and a bad boy. And this is, we were both saying, one of them is Italian, right? His name is Tony. He's a young Italian stallion who can fuck her all night and never come, never lose his erection, and is just kind of like
a horny motherfucker.
He's a fucking like power drill. He's like insanely ridiculously drawn,
and he's so coarse.
His term of endearment for her, his term of endearment for her is cunt.
Yeah,
and she seems to love it. So, I mean, did you find Tony sexy?
I have to say, I found Tony sexy in a way that I find occasionally a big, stupid, loud motherfucker to be really sexy.
Well, he's like a young 24-year-old, slightly involved in criminal activity. He's a Vietnam vet. He's got shrapnel in his leg, which he doesn't want to talk about.
He's
just
argumentative. Yeah. And he's testy and he's unpleasant.
And he calls her up and he's like, hey, cunt, I'm coming over on Saturday night. You better be ready. And she's like, there.
Soon, getting horny on the phone.
And yeah, and she soon recognizes that he gets most worked up not when she shows him that she wants sex. So she does things like saying like, oh, I'm so sleepy. I better just lie down. Like, I don't know if I can do it. Like, they're enacting a kind of rape violence that they both get off on, but it's all consensual and for the most part, all quite fun. Like,
yeah, and there's parts where like, there's like 5 years into her sexual life as an adult, that she has a blowjob with someone, with Tony.
Right, and yeah, that is presented in this horrible fashion.
It's so horrible. Okay, listen, we all know what it's like when you're not prepared for someone to go splot, okay?
Down your...
Yeah, and that does happen.
Windpipe.
And like, you know, you and I have sex with men, Brian, so...
We do?
We do.
Is that what we've been doing?
That's what we've been doing. There is a different dynamic when it comes to male-female relationships. She does suck his dick while he's like eating her out. And he comes and she gags and she's like, oh my God, this is horrible. This is the horrible thing that ever happened to me. But the language that Judith Rosner uses is just so horrific.
In that section, I mean, for the most part, I think she has fun with Tony.
Yeah, I mean, cause in the same part, she realizes that, you know, it wasn't all so bad, whatever, whatever. That's fine. It's just that these moments of things that happen feel like indelible things that she's never going to recover from.
And I guess on a narrative level, what I think really ratchets this up to the reprehensible level for me is because we know this woman is going to die at the hands of a violent rapist. Mm. So this affair that she has with Tony, it is fun and it's enjoyable. And like, if this was Samantha from Sex and the City, you know, 40 years later or whatever it is, 20, 30 years later, it would all be like, great, she's a fun, you know, independent, liberated woman. But here, it's all foreshadowing of the fact that because she likes this kind of sex, she will ultimately die in this terrible way. And it's then paired with this relationship that she has with this other guy, James Morrissey. And James is everything that Tony is not. Number one, he's Irish.
He lives with his mother.
He lives with his mother, who's paralyzed. He's been educated by the Jesuits. He's very chaste, right? He, like, speaks in complete sentences. He's very polite. He always wears a necktie. It takes ages and ages before he even makes any move to kiss her or anything. He's basically courting her in a very old-fashioned sort of 50s kind of way, right? And he's also handsome and lovely, and I felt for James. And she bifurcates this experience. She's like, I have absolutely no sexual attraction to James, but she likes to keep him around. She likes to talk to him. She sort of unburdens her mind with him, right? She doesn't want Tony to know anything about her mind. She doesn't want Tony to know anything, even that she's a school teacher. She just wants to fuck. And she cannot unite the two.
But also, this is where it gets, you know, just more unpleasant, is that Teresa is so mean to James.
Oh, it's terrible.
Like, so she sees him as this neutered, wet loser who is good to have around, you know, to cuddle with occasionally, but who she cannot imagine having sex with.
I mean, eventually they do have some sex, and Teresa is horrified that James wants to wear a condom, right? Because I think he's maybe fearful that he's going to get a venereal disease from her.
Or get her pregnant.
Yeah, he's just like a kind of upstanding guy. And she just finds this like the wimpiest milquetoasty thing he can do. Yeah. And they do repeatedly have sex, but she goes at great length to tell us in her internal monologue, yeah, it was painful at first. Now it's not painful, but she gets absolutely no pleasure out of their repeated.
Nothing.
Yeah. And I think, again, the underscored message here is that if Teresa's mind were not saturated with horniness, if she could find, like, quote-unquote domesticated sexual pleasure or affection for this man who is clearly much better for her, then she could have just been happy with him and she'd still be alive today. I don't see that there's any other way to read this book. Hilariously, you and I realize, because here we have this young Irish girl, independent, trying to choose between a bland and stable Irishman and a slightly more infatuated Italian. We were like, this is Saoirse Ronan all over again in Brooklyn, except like the X-rated version.
Yeah, it's like 20 years later. Yeah, Emery Cohn's big cock. He's ramming into her. He's easing her out all the time. He's coming down her throat.
He does that amazing technique where he like pours red wine all over her body.
Yeah, and upper, and then sucks it out. Like, I found some of this to be quite horny.
I was taking notes, but and then the Donald Gleason version is James, who, I mean, I freaking love James, and I had a lot of sympathy with him when we learned inevitably that as a Catholic undergraduate, he had a homosexual affair with a Jesuit, and that he wasn't really into it. But like, yes, of course, wimpy, faggy James has done that. So,
well, you know, Brian, I have to be honest with you and the listeners that I really identified with Terry a lot in this. And
Terry being Teresa.
With Teresa, and you know I did.
Why?
I thought about myself, and I thought about other kind of gay men, you know?
Uh-huh.
Like, you can be hedonistic and you have this wonderful, hot, horny, anonymous sex, which is fantastic. And then at the same time, it's like, oh, maybe I should settle down with the person that's, you know, good and stable and right and a good choice and someone I can bring home to my parents and stuff.
Do a podcast with.
Do a podcast with.
Read classic novels in bed with, for instance.
It's like, yes, you can get both of those things if you negotiate the relationships in the way that you want, but society is always saying that you can only have one or the other.
But at the same time, you also should try for both.
Yeah, right. But Teresa has the same kind of insecurities, the same questions about herself, you know, body image, the best girl syndrome.
She feels remarkably like a gay man in the Grindr age. Hilariously, she's also very homophobic, and the few homosexual characters who appear are like complete limp-wristed Nancy boys.
Yeah, and she called everyone a queer and a fag and a queen, and it's like, Teresa, come on. Don't be such a square.
Get woke, Teresa.
Yeah.
I would also say that the other contemporary queer psychological phenomenon reminds me of, you know how like RuPaul always talks about people being their own worst saboteur, like self-sabotage. I mean, Teresa exemplifies this completely because she's like internalized completely the Madonna horror complex. And actually, lovely James, for all his Jesuit education, even after he learns about her sexual past, he's ready to still marry her. He just doesn't want to share her sexually with too many other men. But it's her who can't unite this idea of hot and horny desire. It's not even like marriage and domesticity. It's just like emotional support.
Yeah.
And I think this is all Judith Rossner saying, like, look, this woman's brain is so fractured and fragmented. And at every point along the way where she kind of thinks, oh, this is nice, I kind of like him, but then she's also just like insulting him at the same time. And that is the self-sabotage that's going on. I just have to ask you, like, I totally get that you could relate to aspects of Teresa, perhaps in the same way that I could relate to aspects of Erica Kohut from The Piano Teacher. And that probably explains the difference between us. There are similar plot lines. They'd actually make an interesting double feature. I just go more in for, you know, Bach and Beethoven and less for
weed and wine. There's a lot of dope smoking in this, which I quite enjoyed.
Yeah. But as it wraps up to a conclusion, and we kind of know we're headed towards this murder that we've read about in the very beginning, did you then think, oh, when we finally return to this, I'm going to understand something more about this than I did at the start?
No. You understand her motivations, but the death of this character serves no other purpose than to get the author's agenda on paper.
I know we don't typically do this, but could I read the last paragraph of the book?
Yeah, okay. I'm not giving a trigger warning or anything, because if you're listening this far, you're well able for it. It's just that even I thought this was pretty unpleasant.
This is literally how the book ends, with an internal monologue of a woman being brutally sexually violated and killed. Then suddenly the pillow was over her face, and terror blotted out her mind entirely so that her body kept struggling, but her brain wasn't working at all. It snapped back for a moment because the pillow loosened on her face, and she could feel his fingers between her legs invading her vagina, and she caught her breath and heaved under him, and somehow the pillow was off, and he was a huge mass looming over her, sticking his penis into her, and she began screaming again, and he tried to cover her mouth, but she kept screaming, and then he had the lamp in his hand raised over her head, and it was going to come down on her head, and help, mommy, daddy, dear God, help me, do it, do it, do it, and get it over. It literally ends with the letter W and a dash.
Yeah. Oh, that's horrible.
It's horrible, but it's also not brought us anywhere.
No, it hasn't.
And all I have to say is, like, the film executive who read that and then said, I know, Diane Keaton. I am fascinated to know how this has been turned into a movie.
Well, when was The Godfather?
The Godfather is 1972.
Diane Keaton had established herself as a dramatic actress first.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's not to say that she's not a great actress and ready for this. I'm just saying, like, the idea of watching some of this depicted on screen, is this movie just going to end with this brutal crime? Are we going to feel anything more for this character? Also, like, the New York that's depicted in this novel is this violent hellscape, right? Like, it's all pimps and hippies and drug dealers and winos and crime, right? I think we forget that, like, 1977, it's also the same New York that gives us Travis Bickle in Taxi Driver, like, a year later, and the porno theaters and the dirt and the grime. I think it's really fascinating that in 1977, Diane Keaton did this film and also Annie Hall. And there were moments where I think you kept thinking of, like, what if Annie Hall were in this situation with, like, guys coming onto her in a bar?
Oh, geez. Yeah, you want to go home with me? I'm for sure.
Fine. Oh, God. Yeah, you're going to screw me? I mean, what would Granny Hall have to say?
You're what Granny Hall would call a real cunt.
Yeah, I mean, I am so glad that the normal prejudice for dramatic roles that the Academy has did not apply in 1977. Because obviously they could have given Keaton the Oscar for this, and she may well be very good in it. But Annie Hall is, like, one of the most iconic film creations ever. And the fact that it won the Best Picture as a comedy and won Diane Keaton her Oscar is something I will always be happy for whenever the Academy goes for a comedy. But what do we think of Diane Keaton? We've never covered her.
Yeah, like, she's a quality actress with many different notes, who has a filmography which in recent years obviously is not so hot. She's a woman of a certain age. That's not her fault.
I mean, I guess she just decided that something's gotta give.
But think of it. The Godfather Part 1, Part 2, there's Reds, there's this. There's Annie Hall.
Shoot the Moon, yeah, with Albert Finney, which is this great searing drama about a divorce. She's in Marvin's Room,
yeah.
Baby Boom.
Yeah, of course.
First Wives Club. I mean, her comic chops are amazing. Not least, perhaps, in Manhattan Murder Mystery.
Which is one of the best Woody Allen films, yeah, honestly.
So I think we know Diane Keaton as, like, your dizzy, likable, neurotic everywoman. She's also this amazing dramatic actress, if less so now than she used to be.
Well, she's now in The Young Pope, isn't she? So she gets, and that's been well received, hasn't it?
As a nun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Scheming nun.
Yeah. She's also beautiful and sexy. I think something I've always loved about Diane Keaton as a real-life public persona is that she has remained forever single. She's never married.
Really?
She's been in all these high-profile relationships with her co-stars and her directors. I mean, most notably Woody Allen and Warren Beatty.
Mm-hmm.
But I love that she's just this independent woman, kind of seems like she's in charge of her own career. Whenever you see her interviewed, she just seems like she's loving life, and she's got her own sense of grammar, her own sense of fashion and style. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
She seems like a free spirit. In a way, I hate to say it, Meryl seems slightly forced. Like, Meryl seems like she's overperforming that kooky free spiritness in quotation marks. Whereas Diane Keaton, to me, always feels like she's just living it.
Yeah.
if you met Diane Keaton today in 2017 and asked her about playing this woman who is essentially independent, sexually liberated, not wanting to be tied down, Teresa Dunn, and it ends so violently, like, would Diane Keaton have any qualms about, like, kind of the message that this movie sends?
I don't know. We haven't seen it yet.
Well, I know that.
Yeah. But I have a feeling that if I ever met her, this would be the film I'd want to talk about.
Yeah. What would you say?
Well, I'd say, did you enjoy making the film? Did you have a good time? Was it a good shoot? Is Tuesday World nice? Like, that's why I'd ask her right now, considering I don't know dickety shit about it.
She gets to fuck Richard Gere.
And this is pre-American Gigolo, so in many ways Richard Gere is nothing more than a body to fuck, you know? He's not an actor. He's just a torso. Torso and a dick.
Do we think...
No ass.
Do we think we're going to find this movie arousing?
No idea. I really don't. I know you want to get better answers out of me, but I'm really excited. Mildly apprehensive.
Okay. On that note, let's get some Mary Jane, shall we?
Yo, please.
I'll get the red wine.
I'll get a funnel.
We'll cuddle up and we'll see what Teresa done.
Seen the movie. Yeah, Pacino or something, right?
Mm-hmm.
You alone?
Uh-huh.
Come here a lot?
Hmm.
You're okay. Well, most of the others in here are dogs, you know, but you're okay. I'm gonna make you an offer you can't refuse.
Oh, really?
You and me in bed, right?
Yeah? What can I refuse, huh?
Well, you've been passing up the best fuck of your life.
Oh, God. Uh-huh. Okay, well, in that case...
Sean? I just want to say one thing. I'm a pitcher, not a catcher, and don't you ever forget that.
Well, I woke up in a room full of asses, and I was one of them. And that, my friends, dear listeners, is two of the best pieces of dialogue in Looking for Mr. Goodbar.
And let it be known that a lot of the most quotable lines were not in the original novel. They were Richard Brooks' originals.
Sign of a good screenwriter.
I think we'll get into that. That kind of nervous tick that you just did has a bit of an Annie Hall quality. And I have to say, your impersonation of what Diane Keaton was going to be like in this movie was not 10 million miles away from what she actually did.
Yeah, when I was making those impressions of her in the first half, I didn't think they were very good, but, you know, watching the film, I was like, actually, they're pretty accurate.
By which we mean that, although she was playing this sexy, fucked up psychological role, she was still kind of playing it a bit like Annie Hall, just with the speed slightly turned down.
Yeah, like so, Annie Hall and Valium.
Well, first of all, it has to be said, the movie begins when she's a college student, and she has a bit of the Andrea Zuckerman problem from 90210 that she, like, clearly is about 25 years older than she's supposed to be.
She's not 25 years older than she's supposed to be. We make her 43, right?
She looks very mature. What I'm saying is that in the plot, a big deal has to be made of the fact that she is an undergrad, a first-year undergrad, sleeping with her professor. But she looks like an adult woman.
Well, you know, people in the 70s were much more mature in how they presented themselves.
Okay.
They wouldn't wear sweatpants to class. Ugh.
Anyway, she has her first sexual experience. Her professor is, like, touching her and, you know, having coitus with her.
Fondling her, having his way with her.
And Diane Keaton's version of Teresa Dunn just says things like, oh, geez. Oh, God.
Oh, God.
Oh, my.
Oh, here it comes. Oh my God. Oh, it's coming.
It's not to say, I don't want to be dismissive of Diane Keaton. Like, she's never anything other than watchable in this film.
That's true of her in anything, really.
I just don't know that it's the Teresa Dunn of the book, who is this woman suffering from a sort of deep schizoid sense of her own Madonna whore complex.
Yeah, but don't you think that's Diane Keaton in general? Is that she's the kind of actress who has beats and tics and mannerisms that are Diane Keaton?
You know, people think she's kind of the same in every Woody Allen movie. Absolutely not true. If you go back and watch Manhattan, she's acerbic, caustic, a real bitch. And then in something like Reds, I think she's far more interesting, has a strange sense of sexuality. And the same in something like Shoot the Moon. I just think, like, in this one, she's probably falling back on some of those Diane Keaton tics because I'm not sure there's a clear sense of direction or character for this version of Teresa Dunn.
I've never seen Reds, but I relished the opportunity to see Diane Keaton in anything dramatic. You know when you see someone in films at a certain age of your life and you kind of assume that they are that way forever? So think of it this way, Bri. I started seeing Meryl Streep in her post-Death Becomes Her years. That's when I became sentient. So the idea of Meryl Streep being, like, weird and icy and can't act below the neck was a real revelation to me when I started seeing those films. So the idea of Diane Keaton was always, like, First Wives Club, Bad Nora Ephron movies.
Father Baby, of the Bride.
Baby Boom, Father of the Bride, those ones. When I found out that Diane Keaton was in The Godfather, I think I had to, like, check I wasn't wrong with people. I'm like, you know, Diane Keaton from, like, the Woody Allen films. And just the idea of her being in a dramatic role was baffling to me.
I don't know if she's doing a thing where she's slightly lost, feeling like she has to bring something to this role that's not really there enough in the script or enough in the direction from Richard Brooks. I mean, it's also worth saying that the novel is set in the mid to late 60s. There's references to Bobby Kennedy's assassination and the teacher strike in New York and all this stuff. The film, from the opening shots and the disco score, is very, very clearly set in the late 70s. Yeah,
it's terrific.
Yeah, if you're into disco music, it's fine. But what I'm saying is, I mean, she's walking around very 70s New York, which is a different thing than the 60s, yeah? Every street corner seems to have a go-go dancing palace.
It's like that city sustained itself on go-go girls, go-go boys, and porno theaters.
Yeah, so it's a kind of swinging 70s picture. Somehow, I think you lose that sense of the loss of innocence that was coming as a generation is like exploring sexuality and the sexual revolution. It comes at a time when it's all really curdled already, and there's constant reference to things like the women's movement and consciousness raising groups. There's even Jimmy Carter's voice is heard on the news at one point.
Would you say the tone of the film is a lot more misanthropic, with New York just being like really gross and dirty? It kind of felt, you know, that everything was fucked anyway, no matter what happened.
Well, yeah, that's what I mean. Like, and I think you also have this weird phenomenon where Richard Brooks, who's a filmmaker I don't know much about, I looked up his other credits. You know, they're classics of kind of late 50s and 60s cinema, like Elmer Gantry and Sweet Bird of Youth. I mean, he, I can only assume, cut his teeth in the waning days of the studio system. Mm-hmm. And this movie, he is not a 70s new wave filmmaker, right? He's not the generation of Scorsese and Coppola and Robert Altman. So it has this weird quality where it's like selling the swinging 70s to middle America.
Yeah.
It's like representing all the worst tendencies, orgies, and we have singles bars and disco music. And
also cocaine.
So much cocaine. Which,
yeah, which is not in the book. Because in the book, it's all just weed.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I guess, of course, they're bringing it up to 1977. We learned something, didn't we? Because at first we were like, what drug are they taking? I've never heard of a drug called, quote, some white lady named Bernice.
I love that.
Why is Bernice a slang for coke?
I don't know. I mean, I understand the white lady part.
Yeah, no, I know. I feel that the film is more of a wholesale condemnation of an entire culture. There's a very prominent scene, which is only in the film, toward the end, where she has really become strung out on drugs. She's missed work. She's juggling all these different kind of men. She's essentially being a whore. I mean, at some point,
she seems to get paid for it somehow.
Yeah, the men are like at least leaving her tips. I mean, it's really, she literally seems like she's acting like a prostitute. She comes home to do something at her house in the Bronx, and her father, that man, whoever it is who plays the father, like overplays every single line reading from the beginning of the movie to the end.
I know, I've met Irish men like him.
Have you?
Oh, yeah. I have seen an Irish father shouting, shouting his face off until he'd shout no more.
And also, were they wearing their Notre Dame football jacket?
No, they were wearing some weathered county GAA jersey.
Anyway, so in that scene...
All the bollocks.
He delivers this tirade, which is essentially a condemnation of everything the baby boomers of the 70s have done.
I don't understand you. I don't understand your crazy world. I don't understand your crazy talk. Freedom this and freedom that. Free to leave your family. Free to quit the church. Free love. Free to abort your own kids. Free to go to hell.
She responds quite forcefully, and it seems like she's standing up for social progress. But at the same time, the narrative structure has shown how every single choice that she's made has led her into soulless desperation. And within a few more minutes, she's about to die.
Do you think because Richard Brooks is a man who kind of began in old Hollywood, he wrote this screenplay as well? He actually wasn't the hip counterculture voice that you needed.
He directed Butterfield 8.
Oh, that's the slut of all time.
Exactly. Liz Taylor. And I mean, this movie could be subtitled Slut of All Time. But I think, and that's what I'm saying, is the like weird tension, because I don't think Diane Keaton wants to play that. Diane Keaton wants to play this woman as a more intelligent, a woman with greater agency. And yet aspects of the narrative just want to demonize her choices and her behavior. And it just, it feels like she's acting in a different movie that doesn't quite work here. And then ultimately she's punished in the most horrifying way. And the film has this like weird sociology that it's like, I'm a square filmmaker who's descending into the world of the natives to like report back to you. It's like Diane Fossey among the swingers. Do you know what I mean?
Well, let me tell you what did work though, Brian, was the changing of her teaching profession to a teacher of deaf children. It's based on the real life woman this was written about originally.
The real life murder victim. She was a teacher for the deaf.
Yeah, but I do think Diane Keaton is great at this part. You know, Terry Dunn isn't a total fuck up. She actually is really good at her job. She really likes the children. And she goes out, gets stoned, gets drunk, and gets rode. She's a person who's dedicated to helping these children, to teaching herself sign language, to making their lives better.
And we see repeated scenes of her with the children. We get to know the children. We get a very young and hunky LeVar Burton.
Also, he was the "and" in the title credits. Did you notice that?
Explain to our listeners what the "and" means.
Okay, so for me, if you're an "and" in the title credits or on the poster, I'm pretty sure I've said this on this podcast before, it means you get a great moment and you're gone.
You still haven't explained what it means. It means in the credits... Oh, they you know give what I mean. The whole cast and they just say, and LeVar Burton.
And Dame Peggy Ashcroft.
Do you think that it's different if it says, and introducing?
It's basically gone from cinema now. Like, introducing used to be something that I saw a lot. Introducing Hayley Mills, introducing Pia Zadora.
Anyway, this is a long tangent to say that LeVar Burton, a very young, sort of teenage-seeming LeVar Burton...
Who's still gorgeous, by the way.
Yeah, he's the older brother of one of Teresa's students. You're right, those scenes of her teaching the deaf children... First of all, she seems very adept with the sign language. I mean...
She's better than
Jane Fonda?
Jane Fonda winning her Oscar.
Do it.
I am so happy to win for coming home.
What was it about sign language in the 70s? It suddenly seems to have burst into popular consciousness.
Listen, Jane Fonda, she explains that she believes that they're forgotten people.
People suddenly became aware because Jane Fonda's doing her Oscar speech. They started signing the songs at the Oscars for a little while. Lily Tomlin has deaf children in Nashville, and there's this.
Mr. Holland's Opus came 20 years later.
All of this was to say that, what did you think the effect of those scenes where she's being a teacher was?
I'm going to be honest, I found them really affecting. I felt that Teresa was a genuinely good person.
It highlights even more so, you're like, really, is the thesis of this movie that it's impossible for her to not get married and to sleep with a few different men and be a good teacher and have sexual pleasure?
Yes, let's think about it. She keeps down her own apartment. She supports herself financially.
And she pays for all the drugs.
Yeah. She has a great job, which is rewarding and doing great for the community. And she has a wonderful sex life. Why does she need to die?
Well, exactly. And to make matters worse, she dies on New Year's Eve and she makes a New Year's Eve vow that this is going to be the last night she's out. And then she gets killed. So she's also kind of compos mentis enough to kind of realize, oh, I've gone a little bit too far. I guess the parts of this movie just don't cohere for me. I guess we're supposed to feel, oh, what a bad woman she is because she had sex with Richard Gere and then taken a few extra quaaludes to come down from the drugs. She misses school, the kids are feeling terrible, and we're supposed to think, oh, this is just the beginning of a slippery slope. I mean, come on, let this woman like make one mistake in her life.
I mean, come on, I teach with a weed over all the time.
I'm sorry. I apologize. I'm late. Last night, I took a pill to help me sleep. The pill was so strong that
I don't believe it. I don't believe it.
Now, Sean, one of the big questions that we were wondering was, how is the sex going to be handled? We do see Diane Keaton's breasts.
A fair bit, and her butt.
Yes. Yeah. I'm not sure it was actually her butt.
I think it was. I mean, if you're going to show your tits, you might as well show your ass.
I guess so.
That's how I live my life.
It's just a bit harder to hide that they're your tits if your face is also in the shot. Yeah. First of all, like, who does she have sex with?
With her college professor.
Who is not handsome. He has that weird 70s afro thing. It's a bit like Tony Roberts in Annie Hall, the friend, you know?
Yes, actually yeah. It is. But you know, when anyone is your university professor, you still would sleep with them regardless.
Yeah, except that in this case, they're about the same age. Yeah. But anyway, so...
So she sleeps with him, and then she sleeps with Tony, played by Richard Gere.
Now, how do they meet?
Oh my god, this is so weird and so amazing. She is in Mr. Goodbar, or whatever, wherever she is, and she's reading a book. What book is she reading, Brian? Only The Godfather.
Now, just to make this a little bit clearer, in the novel Looking for Mr. Goodbar, Teresa reads The Godfather. But the novel is set in the late 60s when The Godfather was a best-selling book. So I'm sure Judith Rossner was just like, it's the most popular book of the time. But so then they cast Diane Keaton in the role, and instead of just changing the book to something else that would be more appropriate to 1977...
Carrie, maybe.
They have her and Richard Gere exchange this, like, in-jokey conversation. Do you remember the things
he
says?
Yeah, he's like, oh, Al Pacino was so great in that movie.
She's like, oh, yeah. And then he's like, I'll make you an offer you can't refuse. Best fucking of your life. Now, we were a little bit disappointed, weren't we, by the initial sex scene between Tony and Teresa.
Well, it's because all the goddamn sex scenes happen in the dark.
Yes, honestly. And this is what I'm saying about the kind of, like, clunky discretion that I can only attribute to Richard Brooks.
Like, if you're going to say the word cunt in a film, you might as well, you know, show sex scenes at the same time.
I mean, you can kind of see what they're doing. He's sort of eating her out and... doing other things, but it's in this dim sort of candle shadowy light. Now, so we were a bit like, oh, I guess we're not going to get anything really hot.
And then the lights go on. I don't know if this is a common 70s thing, but I'm into it. Richard Gere gets up and he does push-ups in a nice white jockstrap. A bit like the typical traditional bike jockstraps that we all have tucked away, at least one, somewhere in our underwear drawer. And he looks great, and we see his lovely ass and his lovely body. And you know, Richard Gere, for me, is a deeply embarrassing human being. I don't know why. He looks embarrassing.
He's done wonders for Tibet.
Yes, of course. He's done wonders for
Tibet. And gerbils.
And gerbils. But he, when he was younger, was really fit.
In a way, his role here is a bit like a scarier version of, say, Brad Pitt in Thelma and Louise, right? He's a sort of love object to be fetishized and worshipped over.
And he gives, like, an awakening to the female character.
He doesn't believably seem to me very Italian, but
well, he does
fine.
The whole I'm insane thing very well.
Yeah, so the book, his tics are that he, like, taps his fingers a lot and is very antsy and, like, dances around and, like, plays with a switchblade. Richard Brooks's direction of him seems to be like, jump around as insanely as possible. And then, like, he says to Diane Keaton, giggle, like, you find this really amusing. And she just, like, he's dancing around like a whirling dervish, and she's giggling like a woman who's on laughing gas.
Oh, jeez, you're so funny. Oh, God, I have to take you home.
Her other sexual partner is James. Here they've changed James's profession, his role, his entire character. Was that successful to you?
So James in this version is like a welfare officer.
He's not dressed in a pinstripe suit and a tie. He's not a typical square. And I just think it takes away this interesting dialectic that, like, dominates the book. This version of James, he's, like, kind of a swinger, but not really. He also insinuates himself with the family up in the Bronx, but he goes out with her to, like, the clubs. Yeah. And also, he's super aggressive to her. James, in the book, is this man that you're like, oh, why is Teresa treating him so badly? Here, I was just like, I don't give a shit about you. I don't want her to marry you.
Yeah, because in the book, he's presented as the complete opposite of Tony. And in this, he's just...
He's a less attractive, less interesting, less nice...
version
of anybody.
Yeah.
And he also, when he learns that she's sleeping with other guys, he sort of stalks her and follows her around, which I think, again, makes him super unlikable and makes you want to say, yeah, right. I mean, you can sleep with whoever you want. This guy is stalking you. He's following you around and trying to police your vagina.
I don't know. Maybe they thought that, like, in the 60s, where the book is set, there could be a character as passive and as pasty and as lame as James. And then maybe that wouldn't really wash the same way with the 70s audience. I don't know.
Now, we have to say something about the way that this movie ends. Because after all those dimly lit sex scenes, clearly Richard Benjamin and his Oscar-nominated cinematographer and their editor, they've been building up to this set-piece final scene. And you know that they've been building up to it because at one point, James buys Teresa a birthday present or Christmas gift, which is a strobe light, which is a really weird-ass thing to give someone.
But it's perfect for the ending of the film.
Because we are going to watch her be brutally killed in a kind of flashing strobe light by Tom Berenger.
My two cents, first of all. I think it's really crap when the person who has the biggest consequence on the film is brought in the last 5 minutes or something. You know what I mean?
Well, again, he's just a random deus ex machina. Like, in a sense, as we've said, Teresa's already gone on this journey where she's had some semi-violent sex, she's had some moments of maybe skirting more dangerous things, and she's thinking to herself, oh, I'm gonna not do this anymore. And then that one last time, she meets that one person who just is a little bit more trigger-happy than the people she's been with before, Tom Berenger. Well, we first see him in drag. He's the one who gives that aforementioned line, I'm a pitcher, not a catcher, and don't you ever forget that. So he's hanging out with a bunch of reveling queers. I mean...
I found this so confusing.
Yeah, so not for nothing, just like in Steve McQueen's reprehensible film Shame, where, you know, the sign that Michael Fassbender in that film has descended as far down the sexual rabbit hole as he could possibly descend into degradation is when he goes into a gay bar and gets his dick sucked. It's the same with Teresa. The sign that she's, you know, not just a whore sleeping with men, but she, oh, heaven forbid, she goes out to gay bars and we see the kind of prurient camera, you know, scrolling around as, gasp, men kiss each other.
Can I say, that was one of the only scenes in the film where people actually seemed happy.
Yeah, well, these gay people were happy, but we're not meant to be happy that Teresa is in amongst them. And she ends up picking up this guy. Maybe he's sort of gay for pay or he's like insecure about his sexuality. She takes him home. He's sniffing poppers all up the wazoo.
Well, that's a sign, darling. Leave him in the bar. It's not up the wazoo, Brian. That's where he wants it to go.
But he can't get it up. Teresa doesn't want him there anymore. And then in a violent conclusion, he just kills her. And it is so hard to watch.
Yeah. Now, we have seen our fair share of violent films. I know it's not real, okay? But when the film is so deeply unpleasant, and you know that everything's building up to this one appalling scene. It's one of those things where, why show the violence if you're not going to show the sex?
He is true to the spirit of Judith Rossner. It's essentially the visual cinematic representation of that same abrupt and horrific ending that just leaves you hanging and horrified, you know? But I thought somehow that because he'd made so many different choices narratively throughout the film, Tuesday Weld's character of the sister is still living upstairs. I was waiting for some kind of coda or epilogue where, I don't know, maybe the killer runs out, slamming the door. We see Tuesday Weld come down and cradle Diane Keaton in some kind of pietà, and at least we're given some kind of emotional conclusion. Instead, in this horrible strobe light, we watch Diane Keaton get bloodied
yeah.
as her face gets smaller and smaller until it just kind of fades away into utter darkness and the credits roll.
Yeah.
I'm sure this seemed like, you know, the most provocative avant-garde thing you could do to kind of say, see what happens to people who live this life. But God, it just leaves you wanting to retch and then take a shower and retch again.
At the very end of it, we were just like, all right, it's done, turn it off, let's go to bed.
Yeah, we then had to go to bed.
Oh, so verdict, we love Diane Keaton.
Of course we do.
Of course we do. No one's the same when we don't. But I don't think she was perfect for this film.
I just think the film wasn't perfect for anyone because it was so poorly conceived. Had they been more faithful to the original, it would have been still retrograde, but at least it would have made some kind of sense. We were trying to think about what 70s actress could have done this better. And I actually, Sean, you hit on it. There's someone who is very Catholic and
she's got a huge mouth.
She kind of has that same lost gamine quality. And she is also associated with Woody Allen. So who would you have cast as Teresa Dunn?
Mia Farrow.
I mean, I don't even know what movies she was making in this time. Was she making any movies? Because she would have had that lost, innocent, girlish quality, and then you could imagine her going on this journey of becoming more cynical, more acerbic, but also still maintaining that lost lamb. I just think Keaton never seems vulnerable enough.
Well, Mia Farrow's strengths in the Woody Allen film was often you didn't know whether she was coming or going. You know, she was always pulled between two people or situations. And in this film, I think that it would have been interesting to see her as the girl who knows that this is the right guy for her to settle down and to be, you know, family oriented, but also to seek out these experiences and these pleasures. And
she would have been much more interesting.
What's a Mia Farrow impression?
What does you say in Rome's Where's Baby?
Don't you like it? It's Vidal Sassoon. Is that good enough? Can I be in looking for Mr. Goodbar now? Actually, I would be very good in this role.
As Teresa Dunn. Would you be in drag?
No, Terry Dunn. That's my name.
Should we get Andrew Hay to do a gay remake? It could still be called Looking for Mr. Goodbar. Actually, the title would make even more sense. So where would it be set? Is it San Francisco? Is it New York? Is it Berlin?
It's set in my bedroom on my phone.
Don't you mean our bedroom?
Oh, excuse me.
Oh, I'm not in it.
It's set in our bedroom on my phone.
I could see the gay remake of this.
But you know for a fact, if there was a gay remake of this, we would be accused of being internally homophobic.
Unless we really thoroughly investigate it and change it enough to make it insightful and have it all make sense.
I do think, you know, you've hit onto something interesting. There was a reason why I connected to the story of the book so much.
Do you hear that, everybody?
Let's do it. I'm into it.
Moonlight 2.
Looking for Mr. Moonlight. I mean, my version would have loads of hardcore sex scenes.
Who would get to play your hot Italian lover?
Somebody from down the road.
I think you'd cast Lucas Hedges.
Lucas Hedges and Tom Holland as evil twinks. Evil twinks who psychologically torment me. What do you think?
I can see it, Sean. Okay, so I think that our verdict on the actual film is that it's interesting but reprehensible. And I would only tell people to watch it if you are in a hardcore second wave feminism seminar.
Or if you're a Diane Keaton completist.
Yes.
Like, I wish I could recommend this film. I really do.
Yeah.
I feel bad. But that's probably because I've just watched Looking for Mr. Goodbar.
Speaking of movies with great actresses from the 70s that we don't see enough of, our next film is Quentin Tarantino's unsung masterpiece, Jackie Brown. This is Pam Grier in the only Quentin Tarantino movie that I unreservedly like. We're not just going to watch the film, but we've also read the original Elmore Leonard novel on which it's based called Rum Punch, which actually has a strong badass woman at its center.
Good, and I am reading it on the beach as we speak.
And I'm dreaming of halloumi. I've just had some cheese called halloumi. Ladies and gentlemen, when we come back, we're going to be buzzing, we're going to be tanned. It's all Greek to us.
I'm going to be extra hairy when I get back.
So that'll be in 2 weeks. And until then, please, please follow us. subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and leave us a rating or a review.
Or you can follow us on Twitter at Broad Appeal Pod or on our individual Twitter handles. I'm at Sean McGarvin X and Brian is at BA Mullen Speaks.
We have a website, www.broadappealpod.com, where, if you're lucky, you may see some shots of Richard Gere's ass.
Yes.
That's a way to boost traffic.
Yes, thanks, Squarespace. You don't pay for anything, but thanks. Squarespace. That's my RuPaul impression. All right, until next time, I've got the funnel, Brian's got the ouzo. We'll see you later.
Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 2, The Secret of the Ouzo. Bye, everybody.